Senator's interview with Hazard on 20 September 78 at Cambridge, and this is now talking with Bart Bach on 5 December, Santa Claus Doc, 1978 at the University of Washington. This is a follow-up to an interview of all of 7 years ago. Now, we've been talking about your previous interview and a few odd questions I had, and let me just go through them briefly. You answered most of them. First of all, the talk at Columbia that you heard by Jansky at a AAS meeting, we agreed was probably the late 30s rather than the early 30s.
Or the mid 30s.
So I'll check that out. The Reber story about when you went down to visit his telescope. I see. Okay. About the radio radiation?
About the radio radiation from the electric and what it might mean.
Okay. Now, on Reber, you say that Struve received Reber's paper and didn't know quite what to make of it, and that you and he went down to...
have a look for it.
Right. And what was the purpose of your visit?
The purpose was for me to get a little background who the hell is Reber, what he was doing, and did it seem like a function operation.
Right.
And
were you impressed with...
Very much. Very much impressed. As a matter of fact, close to Reber was very pleased that Struve and I came, and both had been a close personal friend ever since.
Right. So, now, what was it that impressed you?
Oh, in general, that it had a very polished foundation of real good observation material, with a good antenna there, the black boxes looked impressive, and he clearly knew his electronics much better than any astronomer, and that he had been doing this very systematically, and that he had got all these signals.
Mm-hmm.
So afterwards, I said to offer my own means publish the article. Don't stop it, or you would be in trouble. If, in a very remote way, I told him, it doesn't come out right, and you get criticized, well, you're better off to have published an article that looks very promising and looks
right.
good, than to not have published it and abuse it, and your name will be mud.
Like
the other
words. Like Saha, which you mentioned before, right.
Yeah.
But you also just told me that you were actually the referee for this article.
Yes.
Do you remember suggesting any changes to Reber?
No, I remember.
Now, but were you at Yerkes at this time?
On a visit.
On a visit,
on
just
a visit.
By chance.
Also, and I were good friends, and Priscilla and I were on a visit there.
I see.
I visited Yerkes quite often in those days. Because Morgan was there, Elvis was there, and Kaiser had been coming, Clinton, Chandra, and also Struve was a very close friend of Stella and mine.
Okay. Moving on to, you mentioned a certain luncheon at Harvard in which Doc Ewan broke the news to you that he had given...
Just given 10 minutes before the lunch. Had given the apparatus to Bill Struve.
The original apparatus. Which you had been planning to use.
And he said, you're darn lucky. Well, now you don't have to worry about these old, poorly built black boxes. All that you and Harlow Chaplin got to do is find $25,000 for a new black box.
So was this the businessman that coming out of
no,
your
way? No, you and Knight and the whole thing. You and quite a phenomenon.
Do you think that this was a good move and that it got you better equipment eventually, or
on the whole of it, yes.
Did it slow things down?
No, didn't slow it down like that. He was on the way building it, and then he got big help for the whole thing from Mrs. Agassiz.
Right. You described that.
Yeah, I've heard the story.
Before
back of the cemetery, that we got the money.
Oh no, I haven't heard that.
Oh, may I tell you that?
No.
Mrs. Agassiz was her husband, George Russell Agassiz. By the way, relation to Henry Norris Russell, but
I
think it's the same family. George Russell Agassiz was the chairman of the visiting committee for Harvard Conservatory, and he had always helped us. When he died, he had, of course, a big fortune, and his widow, Mabel Agassiz, was the one who was sort of in charge of it all, his close supervision. And basically, what she was permitted to do is the interest from the great capital then to the Agassiz Museum in memory of Grandpa. But the interest from the interest she could spend, and she could spend about each year sort of $50,000 for good work. And what Aunt Mabel did, Priscilla and I became very good friends with her. And once a year, we got $5,000 from her. Mm-hmm. And that gives sense for different things, special jobs and so. And then we tried once again on the radio suddenly. So what I did is I talked to Aunt Mabel and said, now we need more, we need $25,000 to really get the small 24
right.
radio telescope, to get the black boxes and the other things paid for. We were beginning to get some help from the newly established National Science Foundation, for which I had lobbied, so I got my pay back that way. And then, what happened? Aunt Mabel said, finally, well, this is a much bigger sum than I normally can give. Give me time to think it over. And then Aunt Mabel called up Hilo Shapley and said, Hilo, I'm inviting you to come with me in my car, and we're going to take a little trip, and I'll give you my decision during the trip. So we went there. There came the 1974 Cadillac that she had had all her life. The chauffeur was an opera car, so the chauffeur sat out in the cold outside, and the lady inside threw a blow tube communicated with the chauffeur and pumped. And then we started driving. And she said, you weren't going to take it easy. Everything is under control. I know precisely what I'm doing. And then we drove along Mount Auburn Avenue, and we went to outside Mount Auburn.
I know that cemetery. Yeah, I know the one you mean.
And outside then, the driver knew where to go, and he said, George, here, stop. Stop. And he said, well, I'm a silly old woman, but when I write a big check, I like to be close to where George lies buried. If you go inside the cemetery, there's always fun. Therefore, I thought, here he lies in the other side of the fence. Then she took out the checkbook, and she said, $5 will be straight in the eye. Now, if I write a check for $25,000 for radio astronomy development, will you promise that the telescope and the papers will always be referred to as from the George R. Agassiz radio telescope and from the George R. Agassiz field station in Harvard? He said, otherwise, his grandfather or his uncle, who everybody knows, get the credit, and I'm on George to get the credit. So I looked her in the eye, and she wrote $25,000 in those days for a large sum of money, and that got us really on the way, and Dr. Ewan got most of them.
Nice, very interesting.
That's a nice story. That's a very nice private fundraising story, too.
What do you have to do?
Nothing was very pleasant. Yeah. Oh, we had all these meetings, and she kept it up, and she was very proud, for everybody knows now the telescope is the GRN.
Right.
That was the name of it. So it was never called the Agassiz, the G.R. Agassiz radio telescope.
Okay.
She would love to have that story written up in the book.
Right. Moving on, you mentioned before that when you became director of Mount Stromlo in 57, I believe, that you were actually nominated by Pawsey.
Pawsey was my close friend, and he nominated me.
He was on the search committee?
He was on the search committee. And put my name forward. Mark Oliphant knew a lot about me. He was dean of the school. And Mark Oliphant, now Sir Mark Oliphant, the former governor of South Australia, Mark Oliphant, the physicist, was the one who was very strongly in favor. And they actually asked me would I please apply for this job.
Okay.
And that's how I got it.
But the optical astronomers, what is
a candidate? Good candidate for all the members.
Actually, just
at that time already.
Right, but what interests me though is that the radio astronomers would have that much say at that time over the head of the optical observatory. Why was that?
Well, because the radio astronomers were dual universities and were very famous all over the world, whereas optical astronomy in Australia was rather second rate, and therefore.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted a lot. There was a big fear. I don't know if I ever told you this, but that's a nice story. That when I would come to Stromlo, that I would tear down all the optical telescopes. Is that story?
No.
And the vice chancellor even got worried about this and asked me to put in writing that I would not want to do this.
Uh-huh.
I told the Thai counselor, that doesn't mean that I don't want to keep up my interest in radio astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
But if any one of my students at any time wishes to go to Sydney or South Melbourne,
right.
they must be able to do it. And I, in the first day when as a Thai counselor you put trouble in my way, I'll become an argumentative astronomer, having a radio telescope astronomer. And this works out beautifully. People like John Michael, for example, wrote an optical thesis and was also deeply involved in radio astronomy. Mark Price was a radio astronomer, but came to us all the time. And there was this constant interchange, also at the staff member level. They all used to come when Matthew could finish his math of H2 continuum radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Before he had shown to any of his colleagues, he came to us as problem to show to Wesley to me and talk over where the identification price was, did they have the right positions and the whole thing. So there was an exceedingly close collaboration, which lasted all through my period, which was stopped during the days of agony. And it now is flourishing again under John Matthews, the acting director, and I don't think it will be stopped in the future.
Did you have any ideas of getting the observatory into radio, or is that just something that...
Well, I had the same idea that I wanted to do, that I didn't want to have, I wanted to start a graduate school there, which we did, and lots of good people have come out of it. And that all the people who were in the graduate school would feel equally at home in radio and optical astronomy and would know each other.
Right, but did you want to put any radio equipment?
No, there was no point to it for the CSIRO was setting up a park. We set up Tiny Spring. Tiny Spring was selected from that park for the handy overnight stop for all of our students.
Mm-hmm.
They did that. We all knew each other and we went back and forth. And then if the student needed more time, with John Bolton, like
Ronnie Gifford,
then they would go to the park, or Beverly Hills, for example, another one. And they went back and forth as they wished.
Mm.
And I always told them, you can concentrate, you can't learn all the tricks in both ways, but you can learn enough that you know how to do it and how to use each other's equipment. And they came to us to help out Bernie Mills and others with identifications of radio sources. So the whole thing was a nice, intermixed, unified affair. And that lasted until I quit. And then Agnesy from there on back. There's no more of that. But that's all back now.
Right. Did you know that Clay Allen had a solar thing back in the late 40s?
Yes.
But that didn't last all that long.
No, only a year or two. Clay Allen now lives in Canberra.
Right. I called him up when I was in the
area. Yes, very nice office at Mount Cromwell.
Okay, and then the final thing was the story about Richard Woolley and John Bolton's colloquium.
That I only had by hearsay.
Who told you that? Do you remember?
John Bolton.
Okay.
No,
so I could check with him.
But, or Joe Fawcett. No, Joe Fawcett told me that.
Oh, that's true.
He thought that was Joe, but the one who told me that story,
although it is ironical, I've heard this said about Woolley by other people, but he did write a paper himself in 48 on 3-3 radiation in H2 region. And he also wrote a paper on solar corona in which he gives quite a bit of mention of radio. And so,
Woolley was an open man, but he was a busy person, and he frankly didn't want to be bothered too much. But he had much better relations with Fawcett than Egan had with the Universal Radio Company later on.
Mm-hmm.
That was the quarrel.
Because they were going back and forth. They had a couple symposia at each other's places in the early 50s, I'm talking about. Okay, moving on to some other sorts of things. I was wondering, at Harvard, you were obviously had worked in galactic structure a lot in the optical and on Magellan cloud structure and so forth. Why did you not get into a large-scale mapping program at Harvard? You always rather picked out individual regions.
I had a lot of practice in that I was interested in, and I was Chapley had this major maximum in this 10-week special classification, for example. That went on, and I was the one who sort of asked Miss Cannon to come to play for the Carina region for the first time in great expenses and things like that. But at Harvard at that time, funds were very limited, and with the limited funds and no science foundation around to do bigger things, it would have been a mistake to try to get in there.
Was there any component of reasoning to say that the Dutch were already embarked on this and let them do that and we will concentrate on specific reasons?
Yes, that's what I was. And I had a very strong desire from the beginning on to open up the southern hemisphere of the bush. And that meant that one had to do research in more than one area to show what potential there was. For example, matter of the clouds has been practically exclusively the personal property of Harlow Shapley. And it wasn't really until Shapley towards the end of the climb that I was even by Shapley permitted to go into the matter of the clouds, but they were his private sort of territory. He worked on it, and he, you know, you say otherwise he's certainly the few Milky Way, but that's not too much overlapping.
That's always amazed me about optical astronomy. It happens sometimes in radio astronomy, but not to such a great extent. This territoriality,
and that's not so strong now anymore. But it used to be the relatively strong.
And do you have any idea how this came about?
There were a few people, and the few people became experts on certain fields in certain areas. And those few people.
So there really wasn't much conflict because there were so few people in such a big size.
And no one was paying attention to the southern hemisphere, and that annoyed the Solani a great deal, for me, then being the South African. I fell in love with the southern hemisphere when I got started on the study of the Carina region and all that, and the cold set, the measure of the clouds, and I felt that was just a change